Hello, this is The History Hour with me, Max Pearson. This week, America's war hero General Patton, remembered by his grandson.
This car drives up and this man gets out with these boots and pistols, big cigar and a helmet. And I'm sitting there with a little army pedal car and he turns and looks at me and he says, "Who the hell are you?"
Also, the making of Michael Jackson's Thriller.
Michael got the idea based on a lot of things coming together. I mean, ultimately, he put the thrill in Thriller. But we helped him discover new landscapes in sound.
A publishing scandal from the 1950s.
Lolita, light of my life, fire of my loins, my sin, my soul, Lolita.
And It's a Wonderful Life, the all-time Christmas classic film.
Bell rings and I say, "Daddy, teacher says, every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings."
First, today's news.
Hello, I'm Neil Nunes with the BBC News. More than 100,000 people in Paraguay, Argentina, Brazil and Uruguay have been forced to leave their homes by some of the worst floods in the region in 5 decades. Several days of heavy rain have caused 3 major rivers to swell. Leonardo Rocha has more.
In the worst affected country, Paraguay, the authorities have blamed the El Niño phenomenon for stronger than usual summer storms. The capital, Asunción, has been flooded and has been affected by power cuts. A state of emergency has been declared in several regions of the country. Thousands of families have also been badly affected in neighboring Argentina, Brazil, and Uruguay. Some 20,000 people were evacuated in the Argentine city of Concordia, where the Uruguay River is 14 meters above its normal levels, higher than anyone there can remember.
The mining company that owned a water dam that burst in Brazil nearly 2 months ago says it won't be rebuilt. The dam, used to hold wastewater from iron mining, bursts, killing 17 people and contaminating a vast area with toxic mud. The president of the Samarco company told a Brazilian newspaper that rebuilding the dam had been ruled out because of the impact of the accident for the company. Saturday's planned evacuation of Syrian rebel fighters and their families from the Yarmouk refugee camp south of Damascus has been put on hold. The planned evacuation comes a day after a top rebel commander, Zahran al-Halush, was killed in an airstrike. Here's Lina Sinjab.
We hear from the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights that the road and the buses that would load all the fighters along with their families are still being sorted, and they need to secure a safe road to take them up north to Raqqa. As we understand that the deal includes fighters from Islamic State and as well fighters from Al-Qaeda's offshore Jabhat al-Nusra, in addition to some fighters from the FSA.
Amnesty International says the Cameroonian authorities must come clean over the fate of 130 people rounded up and detained by its security forces a year ago following operations against the Islamist militant group Boko Haram. David Bamford reports.
Exactly 1 year ago, on the 27th of December, more than 200 boys and men were arrested by Cameroonian security forces in 2 villages, Magdume and Duble. According to the government, 70 suspected Boko Haram members were arrested, 25 of whom died that night in a prison cell at the gendarmerie in Marawa. But the whereabouts of at least 130 remaining people are still unknown. Amnesty International says the fight against Boko Haram should not serve as a pretext for enforced disappearances.
BBC News. Reports from northeast Nigeria say at least 14 people were killed and several others injured in an attack on Friday by the Islamist group Boko Haram in northeastern Nigeria. Witnesses say gunmen entered the village of Kimba in Borno State on bicycles, opening fire on residents and burning their homes. A Chicago police officer has shot and killed 2 people while responding to a domestic disturbance on the city's west side. The victims were a 19-year-old man and a 55-year-old woman. Both were black, and their families have accused the police of overreacting. Janet Cooksey is the mother of the teenager who died.
7 bullets was put in my son. 7. 7. That's a bit much. 8 shots was fired. 1 hit an innocent lady that was just opening her door. Something is wrong with this picture. Something is wrong. Something needs to be done.
Heavy rain has caused further flooding in northern England, forcing the evacuation of hundreds of homes. Around 10,000 homes in the region were without power, and many elderly and other vulnerable people have had to be rescued by lifeboat. In a dramatic rescue caught on video, canoeists in Yorkshire freed an elderly man who was trapped in his Land Rover. A 92-year-old Argentine activist says she was devastated after DNA tests showed that a woman she met on Christmas Eve was not her missing granddaughter. Maria Mariani announced on Wednesday that she had finally found her granddaughter, Clara Anahi Taruji, after spending nearly half her life looking for her. She was abducted in 1976 by the military government and probably given for adoption to a non-communist family. But 2 days later, a prosecutor working on the case said official tests showed no DNA match linking the two women. BBC News.
Hello, this is the History Hour with Max Pearson. And in this holiday week, we have some key cultural events from the past relived by those who were there, as well as marking a moment in space history and the passing of a towering figure from the Second World War. And we're going to begin with one of those marker posts on the long and winding road, which is popular music. We're going back to the winter of 1982 and to the release of Michael Jackson's album Thriller. It was to become, and still remains, the best-selling album of all time. It's very likely that some of its tracks will have prompted office workers at Christmas staff parties around the world this past week to have shed their inhibitions and embarrassed themselves on the dance floor. With singles such as Beat It and Billie Jean, it cemented Jackson's title as the King of Pop. Farhana Haider reports.
Michael Jackson's Thriller album was released at the end of November 1982. But it took listeners a while to appreciate just what a revolutionary album it really was.
Michael got the idea based on a lot of things coming together. I mean, ultimately, he put the thrill in Thriller, but we helped him discover new landscapes in sound.
Anthony Marinelli, a 23-year-old keyboard player and synthesizer programmer, was approached to work on the album by the legendary producer Quincy Jones.
Well, I was a go-to kid for performing sounds on records and feature films. And then I started a synth duo that got the attention of a lot of Hollywood filmmakers, and we were doing live radio broadcasts. And then a great songwriter named Tom Baylor heard about us, and we did some work for him, and he recommended us to Quincy Jones.
With Thriller, Quincy Jones and Michael Jackson were determined to use all the new digital technology available to revolutionize their sound.
I had this pretty unique, it was the first computer synthesizer that made digital sounds, and it was very expensive. So I brought this thing in that no one had really ever seen before. So Michael was really interested in the technology of the box. I would show him the sounds that it would make, and that really got him going. The sounds were pretty incredible for then, and there was some sampling too, which was all new. I mean, we had so much gear that we couldn't even put the trunks, all the boxes that everything came in the hallways. We had to have our truck come back because Michael just wanted to hear even the same sound just with different instruments. And we were doing pre-production drums, putting the pipe organ on Thriller, and then it would go into Studio A for Vincent Price to do his talking bit.
Thriller was recorded at Westlake Studios in LA. Anthony was brought in a couple of weeks into production.
When I first got there was when Michael was hitting the drum cases for Beat It. And that was sort of set the tone for where this thing was going, because I knew they were just trying anything. Michael was recording in the bathroom down the hall and redoing his vocals with different mic proximity, like up close, and then he'd re-sing it farther away. So Sometimes I would put down a drum track, and then the next day there would be like amazing musicians showing up, and they would just track it right in the room where we were. And then they would leave, and then we would just keep adding more, you know, parts on it.
Anthony Marinelli says the experimenting never stopped.
So we just started making sounds. You know, Michael at one time would go on to turntables and drop the needle and say, I like this sound, I like this sound. And then I would just make them on modular synthesizers with patch cords. Thriller was called Starlight. That one changed the most because it went from sort of a disco song to completely different lyrics. But I created a sound that went boo at the beginning of the song. The big brass, I used a synclavier, digital synthesizer along with some modular synths, the pipe organ, that was transformed. Billie Jean redid the drums on that. I had a Lindrum, which was a drum machine, and I got special chips from a friend that I was in high school with that gave me the latest chips, and I would bring them in and play them, snare drums, bass drums, hi-hats, and actually go in and physically replace the proms in there. So I used this drum machine on a lot of the tracks, and it just, you know, was the same sort of process. Quincy would cast the perfect sideman or background vocals, but there was a lot of evolution. It's really hard because of the process to pinpoint anything. Michael was right next to us. He was there every day. And he would come in and out. Wherever the action was, he would come in, you know, just get inspired. I mean, it was great to have him there. To have the artist so integrally involved makes a big difference with the vision.
The album was one of the first to use music videos as a successful promotional tool. Three of the singles had them. The 14-minute video created for Thriller is among the most influential of all time. But it was the release of the video for Beat It that propelled the album to number one.
It was the beginning of the whole MTV thing, right? Like visual music. And I think that that was all percolating inside him, you know, because he would dance in the studio. And I think he was seeing it. So that's why the songs had to kind of evolve a little bit and take some turns to kind of fit that vision.
So he'd be dancing in the studio while the tracks were being laid.
He'd be dancing in the studio when he liked what was going on. And when he didn't like what was going on, he'd be quiet.
So that was a sign that he was enjoying.
It often was. And also how loud it was being played, because if he liked it, he would call it sitting in the biscuit and sit in the middle like the two speakers and turn it up so loud that I had to hold my ears. But, you know, that was good.
And was he a perfectionist, would you say?
I think Michael's a perfectionist. I think how he recorded his vocals, like so many passes, like a lot of vocalists would not want to do the same take over and over and over. He just tirelessly would just try anything. If he was into it, that was a pretty unique thing.
Of the album's 9 tracks, 4 were written by Michael Jackson. He was only 24 years old. He'd been working in the music business since he was a small child. And Anthony says that he and the album's producer, Quincy Jones, were on equal terms when it came to creativity and innovation.
Those guys, Michael and Quincy, want to just beat themselves. You know, they compete with themselves.
And what was the relationship like between Michael and Quincy Jones?
Michael and Quincy were both really strong personalities. What they brought, each of them, to it was very unique and, you know, it speaks for itself.
And when you heard the final released album, what did you think?
I just took a deep breath when I heard it and I felt good.
The album eventually reached the number one spot in February 1983. And remained in the top 10 of the Billboard 200 chart for a full year. It won a record-breaking 8 Grammy Awards.
I think Thriller influenced music in a way that combined brilliant songs, vocal performance, great production, danceability, and visual. I mean, that's everything. That's opera. That's film. He raised the bar for doing that in a record, and I think artists today still aspire to do that, taking recorded music to a place that you can live in and experience, and then when you go there, it just opens up your senses. If they say why, tell them that it's human nature.
After Thriller, Anthony continued to work with Quincy Jones. He went on to compose scores for over 80 feature films.
Anthony Marinelli was talking to Farhana Haider. And in fact, it is extraordinary because Thriller is still breaking records more than 30 years after its release and 6 years after Michael Jackson's death. It's just become the first album in history to cross the 30 million mark in US sales. Joining me now is the music journalist Jacqueline Springer. It may be a monumental album, but as a work of art, is it fair to say that it's fairly mechanical in the way that it's a manufactured piece of art because of all the technology that was used to create the sound?
I think what we need to appreciate is that musicians come in different forms, and you can be a musician and you just happen to be a singer. You may not be able to play an instrument, but you've got an innate sense of what is needed, where and how. And you have a meeting of creative minds of unrivaled ambition in Quincy Jones and Michael Jackson working here, as Anthony said, collaboratively, irrespective of their age and experience, and working on something that they know can utilise the technology of the day but still imbue the finest elements of their own individual and collective experiences. You know, we have in Quincy Jones somebody who's worked over decades of recorded sound. You know, Frank Sinatra, Count Basie, he's a peer of the late Ray Charles. He's brought cinematic imagery to sonic life.
So we shouldn't be surprised that two figures, one from the jazz world and one from the pure pop world, if you like, would come together and try to use whatever latest technology was available. It would be perfectly natural for them as musicians to do that.
Nothing was inevitable about this recording. At the time, this was a risk. At the time, we had no idea that that song was going to birth that video and that this album would actually create a multimedia entity before that term even became a buzzword.
Yeah, because the visuals seem to be quite important in the way that Thriller has been seen over the ages. We had Anthony Marinelli talking about it being like opera because of the use of song storytelling and the videos and so forth. How influential has that been? I mean, was this a genuine turning point for popular music and the way it was presented to a wider public?
Absolutely. It's a totemic change in the way in which record companies would subsequently fund music videos, in the fate of MTV, but also in the way in which Michael Jackson would harness his seniority. Because MTV were, just like so many different media platforms, they utilised discrimination on the basis of subjectivity as regards to music taste.
What do you mean? Do you mean that what they were showing on MTV
was limited.
White rock.
It was limited. It was based upon what they perceived to be their audience's main choices. But their audiences also included black people, people of colour, who had broad tastes. They weren't being addressed. Michael Jackson withheld and negotiated the value of his music videos until they actually reassessed the way in which they operated equality.
So Michael Jackson was saying from his Thriller videos, you can't show these unless you show other black artists.
Absolutely.
It seems that music has moved on, musical tastes have moved on, in the sense that you can't listen to Thriller now and think of it as a modern album, and yet it is still selling. I mean, who's buying it?
It is of its time, but what's so very unique about Thriller is that it was released, you know, in 1982, but its vision had no end date. This is the album. No one will ever outsell. Records are not sold and disseminated in the same way. Some people like to have a tangible copy of music.
And it's like acknowledging a turning point in popular music.
I've got three albums.
Three copies of the album?
I have three copies. Somehow I have three in my possession. I have brothers who have more than one copy. We are not allowed to touch each other's material. Things matter to you because you were either there at the time or they subsequently come to matter to you. And I just think that, to quote a popular online term, this is black excellence, when people were assuming that the heyday of black musicianship could possibly have been in the 50s and in the 60s. And this explosion of ideas, it's here in one album for you to go back to over and over again. I don't think I'm alone in thinking that Thriller was a line in the sand.
That's the music journalist Jacqueline Springer. Now, earlier this week marked 70 years since the death of a man who was considered to be one of America's greatest and most colourful wartime generals, George S. Patton. Born in the 19th century, Patton's life spanned the dawn of the age of mechanised warfare. He fought in the First World War, but really stamped his fearsome and charismatic mark on the Second World War. Luis Hidalgo got an insight into the life and death of the man from his grandson, George Patton Waters.
It's the 21st of December 1945, and in a hospital bed in Germany lies one of the most famous commanders of the Second World War. General George S. Patton had hit his head when the car he'd been travelling in days earlier collided with a truck.
I think General Patton died because he was in horrible pain, and it was time.
George Patton Waters is General Patton's grandson.
My grandmother spent 8 or 9 days just sitting there reading to him all day because he was basically in and out of consciousness and couldn't speak very well.
And there was a good chance, wasn't there, that if he'd lived, he'd have been left permanently paralysed, which would have been very hard for someone like him.
And for his grandkids, too. It would be really hell for us. He just wanted to fight. He was born to do that, and he did that. I mean, a lot of what he did he probably shouldn't have done, but, you know, that was just General Patton. He was going to do it, and they weren't going to tell him he couldn't do it.
The Allied nations mourn the death of General George S. Patton, fiery commander of the famous United States Third Army, which swept all before it on the battlefields of Europe. Returning to the ancient Duchy of Luxembourg, liberated a year ago by Patton's army en route to Germany, come the remains of the famous general who survived two wars only to die of injuries received in an automobile accident. His widow accompanies the casket as it is borne in an army vehicle through the silent streets of a grave and grateful city.
The man who'd led the capture of Sicily and whose army had swept through Europe after the Normandy landings of 1944 and whose swearing would become as famous as his military strikes had been born in 1885 into a wealthy army family. His grandfather had served in the Confederate Army during the American Civil War.
He grew up on this farm, like 15,000 acres, which was sort of half of Los Angeles. The people that he would come in contact with as a child were people like General Moseley from the Confederate War. And so his destiny was to lead men into battle and to be victorious. And that's all he dreamed of. He had a little wooden sword, and he would fight with his sister with that. Grew up wanting to be a warrior.
March along, sing a song with the army of the free.
George S. Patton got his first taste of combat in Mexico in 1915. American soldiers were trying to capture the Mexican revolutionary Pancho Villa. They failed, but George Patton famously strapped the dead body of Villa's deputy to the bonnet of his car and drove it through town. It was the kind of bravado the general would become known for.
Patton just had no barriers. He just did what he felt was the right thing to do.
And then during the First World War, where he was injured, that was where he began his love affair with tanks, wasn't it? He was at one of the first battles at Cambrai where tanks were used.
That's correct. I mean, that's when he became a tanker. After the First World War, he actually studied the abilities of tanks, the center of gravities, and what a track vehicle can do under certain conditions. That, to me, is one of his finest intellectual contributions to the military was armored warfare. You know, in World War One, they would always fight in lines. And General Patton broke up the lines and decided that the pincer movements, the spreading of troops, was far more effective.
They were tactics General Patton would finesse years later in the Second World War. In 1942, General Patton was assigned to help plan the invasion of North Africa. The following year, he led the Allies to victory in the invasion of Sicily. His love of battle earned him the nickname Old Blood and Guts.
The blood and guts was not a real positive. The concept was his guts and their blood.
Here's an important piece of news which has just come in. Rome Radio has announced that the King of Italy has accepted Mussolini's resignation.
A lot of people referred to him as Georgie. You'll hear them say, "By God, I serve with Georgie." And he had these 400,000 men liberated Bastogne and all the surrounding cities. And they were off on their own fighting a war for Patton. They weren't working for Eisenhower. They were working for Patton. He led his men. He had no problem riding in a tank, on a tank. And there are very few that are left, but they said Georgie was everywhere.
He was an inspiring leader, but he was also hard on his men. And there was an incident in Italy when he struck a man who, it later emerged, was suffering from battle fatigue.
Well, I mean, I understood that he came into this medical facility and there was a young soldier there who was just shaking, and General Patton looked down at him and, "What's wrong with you, soldier?" And said, "Sir, I'm scared. I just can't go back." And that's when he took his gloves and hit him. And he was going to shoot him, but they talked him out of it. But it wasn't to beat up on this enlisted man, which was totally out of character. It was because he was thinking about those other 400,000 sitting in the holes up on the front line.
General Patton was severely rebuked for that incident and for a while disappeared from view. But in June 1944, he played an important part in the Allied invasion of France. The Allies had put out a rumour that Patton's army would land at Calais, but it was a ploy. He instead landed in Normandy, and his tanks were soon cutting a swathe through Europe. That December, he helped relieve American troops at the Battle of the Bulge. Within months, Hitler was dead and Germany had surrendered.
Los Angeles turns out in force to scream a welcome to two of the war's outstanding heroes, General Blood and Guts Patton and General Jimmy Doolittle. Along the route, nearly 2 million people turn out to acclaim the man who beat the Germans at their own game of mechanized warfare.
In the summer of 1945, a victorious General Patton returned to the United States. It was the first and the last time that George Patton Waters would meet his famous grandfather. He was five.
My mother had sent me outside to sit by the road and wait for him to come. And you have to realize I didn't really know what a man looked like because I had grown up during the war and there were just not any men because they were all in the war. And this car drives up and this man gets out with these boots and pistols, big cigar and a helmet. And I'm sitting there with a little army pedal car, and he very abruptly turns and looks at me and says, "Who the hell are you?"
General Patton stayed with his eldest daughter Beatrice and her family for a fortnight.
He was tall, he was big, he was gruff, and there were two languages. There was one you could use, and then there's one for, as my mother would say, it was for motivating troops. That was a language we weren't allowed to use. I remember my mother and aunt, they hung over him, and, you know, they would all sit together on the couch, and you could see the love that his children had for him.
But he could be a harsh grandfather.
He would put his cigar ashes in our hands and he would say, "So help me God, if you flinch, I'll break every blank, blank bone in your body." And I remember my brother flinched. I learned to take the first ash because it wasn't as hot as the second ash.
And what happened to your brother?
My grandfather just picked him up and he sort of went up in the air. I think it was just his mannerisms. He'd been leading troops for 5 years and we learned quickly to be seen and not heard.
General Patton later returned to Europe to help establish the peace, and it was there that December that he had the accident that would kill him. George Patton Waters remembers his grandmother leaving for Germany, taking books that she'd read to him and his brother to read to her husband on his deathbed.
The Odyssey, the Iliad, poetry. He loved poetry. He had written a tremendous amount of poetry, and he wrote her poems and would send them home in letters, and she probably reread those letters.
George S. Patton was 60 when he died. Over the years, there's been talk of poison and rigged collisions, but his grandson believes there was no conspiracy. It was an accident, the untimely death of one of the legends of American military history.
Luis Hidalgo was talking to George Patton Waters, the grandson of General George S. Patton, who died 70 years ago. And that account is another fine example of the sharp detail and insight you can only get from the first-hand recollections that we bring you. And the story of General Patton will be placed into the World War II Witness Collections section of our website. Just search for BBC Witness. More from the History Hour in just a moment.
Distribution of the BBC World Service in the United States is made possible by American Public Media, producer and distributor of award-winning public radio content designed to engage, inform, and entertain. Delivering the BBC World Service, helping Americans navigate the world around them by bringing world events, cultures, and issues into focus. That's APM, American Public Media.
Coming up in part two of the History Hour, a child actor who starred in one of the all-time great Christmas films, the publisher of Lolita, a book that shocked a generation, and a British attempt to land on Mars.
Good luck to Europe's first mission to Mars.
The spacecraft will parachute onto the Martian surface. Two large balloons will inflate to cushion the impact.
Well, that was the theory. First, here's today's news summary.
BBC News with Neil Nunes. More than 100,000 people in Paraguay, Argentina, Brazil and Uruguay have had to be forced to leave their homes by some of the worst floods in the region in five decades. Several days of heavy rain caused three major rivers to swell, flooding a vast lowland area. The mining company that owned a water dam that burst in Brazil nearly 2 months ago says it won't be rebuilt. The dam, which was used to hold waste water from iron mining, burst on November the 5th, killing 17 people and contaminating a vast area with toxic mud. Saturday's planned evacuation of Syrian rebel fighters and their families from the Yarmouk refugee camp south of Damascus has been put on hold. A monitoring group said there were logistical difficulties. Amnesty International has asked the authorities in Cameroon to explain the fate of 130 people arrested during an operation against the Islamist militant group Boko Haram a year ago. Reports from northeast Nigeria say at least 14 people were killed and several others injured in an attack on Friday by Boko Haram. Witnesses say gunmen entered the village of Kimba in Borno State on bicycles, opening fire on residents and burning their homes. Police in the U.S. city of Houston say a fire that broke out at a mosque there on Friday appears to be suspicious. The fire caused substantial damage, but nobody was injured. A Chicago police officer has shot dead two people while responding to a domestic disturbance on the city's west side. Both were black. Their families have accused the police of overreacting. Chinese media report that a group of miners remains trapped underground after a mine collapsed in the eastern province of Shandong. One miner was killed. And heavy rain has caused further flooding in northern England, forcing the evacuation of hundreds of homes. Many elderly people have had to be rescued by lifeboat. BBC News.
Welcome back to part two of the History Hour with Max Pearson. Still to come, Britain's Beagle 2, a balmy idea or brave and brilliant, and the scandal that surrounded the publication of Nabokov's Lolita. But right now, we'll continue with a slightly festive feel by going all the way back to Christmas 1946 and the premiere of Frank Capra's film It's a Wonderful Life. This is a movie which has been loved by successive generations with its message of hope and redemption. The central character is a good man beaten down by a financial crisis and a scheming local businessman, pushed right to the edge, only to be saved by the love of those around him. Some saw a hint of communist propaganda. The FBI launched an investigation. But the film, like its central message, remains triumphant. Simon Watts has been speaking to one of It's a Wonderful Life's child stars.
Bell rings, and I say, Daddy, teacher says, every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings. And he says, that's right.
Look, Daddy, teacher says, every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings.
That's right. That's right.
How many times do you think you've been asked to say that?
Oh, maybe 1,000. I don't know.
Carolyn Grimes was born and bred in Hollywood. In It's a Wonderful Life, she played the cute, curly-haired Zuzu Bailey.
I was 6 years old when I did the movie. I'd already done four. I started in the movie industry when I was 4 years old. My mother was kind of a stage mother. She was afraid my father was going to be drafted. It was during World War II, and she didn't think she could live on the army pay, and she didn't want to go to work, so she put me to work.
Why are you called Zuzu in the film?
Well, there was a product made in the early 1900s called Zuzu's Ginger Snaps, and they were made by the National Biscuit Company. And it featured a little female clown with blonde hair on the boxes. and that's the name of it. I was named after a cookie.
In the film, Zuzu is the daughter of George Bailey, played by the Hollywood legend Jimmy Stewart. The plot turns on the crisis which George goes through one Christmas Eve. His youthful dreams dashed, George feels trapped in the small town of Bedford Falls. He considers killing himself, but an angel called Clarence appears to show him how much worse everybody's lives would be without him.
I suppose it would have been better if I'd never been born at all.
What'd you say?
I said I wish I'd never been born.
Ooh, you mustn't say things like that. Wait a minute, that's an idea.
After seeing the angel's vision, George Bailey realizes he's not a failure because he's enriched the lives of his family and friends. He chooses to live.
Hello, Bedford Falls! Merry Christmas!
Merry Christmas, George!
George runs home for Christmas, and little Zuzu rushes downstairs to see her daddy.
Have you seen my wife?
George, darling, where have you gone? Oh, George. Who's gonna come, Daddy?
Come, Daddy. Frank Capra, for us kids, he would get down on his knees and he would look at us, straighten our eyes. I remember when I came out that door to see my daddy come back, he had talked to me about, think about how you would feel if you never saw your daddy again. And he'd been gone a really long time. And then all of a sudden, he comes home. Think about how you would feel.
And how did you get on with Jimmy Stewart?
Oh, he was wonderful. He was kind, caring. He was very tall. He was 6'4". I go down the stairs. I'm hanging on to his neck, wrapping my feet around him like a little frog. And, you know, you don't do a scene just once. You do it over and over again. And I was having a blast. It was so fine. And then he let me down so gently each time. And I feel like he really was a George Bailey in real life.
Initially, It's a Wonderful Life was a rare box office flop for Frank Capra. It only became a hit in the late 1970s when the copyright lapsed and American TV stations could show it time and time again for free.
Christ is born in Bethlehem.
Watching the film just before I talked to you, I was struck by how bleak it is. It's not a classic Christmas film, this, is it? There is people that are thinking of ending their own lives. It's quite dark.
It's a very dark movie, and I think that's one of the reasons why it wasn't successful when it came out, because it was right after World War II, and people wanted to laugh and be entertained.
By the time the film took off, Carolyn Grimes was no longer in Hollywood. She was living in a small town in the Midwest. And incredibly, she saw the movie herself for the first time in 1980, 34 years after she'd made it.
I was raising a lot of kids. I just didn't sit down and watch a lot of television. So Mr. Stewart was actually having one of his secretaries look for me about that time because people were wondering what happened to that little girl. And I realized, whoa, maybe I'd better see what this is all about.
So what did you think when you did actually see it?
Oh, I realized what it was. I mean, I cried. How beautiful that a film can touch so many lives. And there's so many people that can identify with George. Maybe their life hasn't turned out exactly like they want it to. But when you see this film, you see that you really do make a difference and you matter.
Carolyn is now a sort of unofficial ambassador for It's a Wonderful Life, attending screenings and signing memorabilia.
I have Kleenex with me at all times, or tissues, because people tear up. And it reminds them of their own situations. And there's comfort in talking about it, and I'm blessed because I get to do it.
Of the stories you've been told about the impact of this film on real people, are there any that have really stuck with you?
Yes. There was a man who came through the autograph line at a show once. He was 17 years old. He was in his bedroom, and he was going to commit suicide. And he got up, walked into his parents' bedroom, got their gun, and he thought, I don't want to do it where they will walk by it. So he said, I went out into the backyard, and that's where I was going to do it. And then I thought, oh, I think I left my TV on. So he went back upstairs to his bedroom, and sure enough, he'd left it on. And it was It's a Wonderful Life that was on. And it was at the very beginning of the movie where you see the moon and the planets and the stars and they're talking and all that sort of thing. And he was a science fiction buff. So he thought this was a science fiction movie. So he started watching it, and then pretty soon he sat down and he said he watched the entire film. And he got up, took that gun, put it back in his parents' bedroom, and he said he never considered suicide again.
What an amazing story. And I was thinking as you were telling it, how wonderful to have been part of a piece of art that has that much power.
It does. I feel it's an honor, a privilege, and perhaps in a way a mission, because my life has not always been wonderful. Life is what you make it. And I was orphaned at the age of 15 and sent out of Hollywood. I lost a son, an 18-year-old son, to suicide. My first husband was killed deer hunting, and my second husband died of cancer. I mean, there's a lot of things that I've done and had happened to me over the years. So I think being Zuzu has really been something it was pre-planned and I was supposed to do. And I'm blessed because I get to do it.
Caroline Grimes was talking to Simon Watts, and It's a Wonderful Life has been a staple at Christmas time in the Pearson household and will probably remain so for many years to come. Next, the British public has had precious few triumphs in space to celebrate. Right now, schoolchildren all over the country have been fired up by the fact that there's a British government-funded astronaut, Tim Peake, on the International Space Station orbiting the Earth. But back on Christmas Day in 2003, Britain was poised to crack a landing on Mars. The probe was called Beagle 2. It was a daring British attempt to look for life on the red planet, and as Rob Walker reveals, to do so at reasonable cost.
It inspired the whole nation such that there were people sitting on the edge of their seats on Christmas morning.
It's early on Christmas morning 2003, and journalists and scientists are packed into a room in central London. They're waiting for news from Beagle 2, the first lander since the 1970s to look specifically for evidence of life on Mars. And all eyes are on Professor Colin Pillinger of the Open University, the driving force behind the mission.
6 o'clock this morning and the first chance to hear from Beagle 2. The project's mastermind is on the line to NASA, but from the Martian surface, there's just silence.
I'm afraid it's a bit disappointing, but it's not the end of the world. Please don't go away from here believing that we've lost this spacecraft.
We'll hear more about what happened to Beagle 2 later, but the story of the mission begins a few years earlier with the unorthodox and hugely charismatic figure of Professor Pillinger. Before his death in 2014, Professor Pillinger spoke to the BBC about the mission on numerous occasions.
It began out of sheer bloody-mindedness. I went to a meeting at the European Space Agency, who I knew were having a mission to Mars, and I said, you really do have to take a lander. And their response to that was, you've never built a lander, who's going to build it? The Brits won't pay for it. And I said, I think this is so important, somebody will do it. We got outside the meeting and we're driving away in the car, and my wife said, are you serious? And I said, yes. And she said, right, you need a name for it. We're going to call it Beagle 2.
And once back in Britain, Professor Pillinger started work with a team to design this Beagle 2, named after the ship that took Charles Darwin on his voyage of discovery around the world in the 1830s. The unmanned Beagle 2 would need to be capable of conducting the complex experiments necessary for searching for evidence of life, but also be small enough to fit on the spacecraft the European Space Agency was sending to orbit Mars.
We had to demonstrate, you know, the actual scale on which we were working. This was going to be tiny. That was when I asked my daughter to make a cardboard model, which she did on her kitchen table.
I remember seeing some sketches because they really did do it on the back of scraps of paper and, you know, back of an envelope.
Susanna Pillinger is Colin Pillinger's daughter.
And we took over our kitchen table making this Beagle 2 model. It was cardboard boxes. It had kitchen roll tubes for the extendable arm. I had all the solar panels that unfolded, and they had, like, you know, tinfoil on the solar panels.
And the cardboard model we carried around in a black bin liner bag and took it to places and said, this is what we're talking about.
Britain boards the Mars Express. Can we beat the Americans in the race to discover whether there's life on the red planet?
What about the money? Are you yet fully resourced?
There is not a pound on the table yet for this lander, and that's an important fact.
But Professor Pillinger wasn't just trying to raise money for the mission. He also wanted to capture the British public's imagination. And that meant bringing on board Blur, at the time one of Britain's biggest bands.
And they started working together to develop the call sign for Beagle 2 that they could actually build into the software that went to Mars. The idea being that when Beagle 2 made contact on Christmas Day in 2003, that the first thing that you would hear would be the Blur call sign.
It was a signal on my mobile phone as well. As it was my ringtone until my phone got run over.
Despite his somewhat unorthodox approach, Professor Pillinger's team succeeded in coming up with a highly innovative design for their Mars lander and built it on a tiny budget in time for the launch of the European Space Agency's mission in June 2003.
We're on the launch pad. In a few days from now, the rocket will ignite and will take us off the Earth's surface. It's the smallest, most cost-effective planetary probe there's ever been.
So we wish now good luck to Europe's first mission to Mars.
The spacecraft will parachute onto the Martian surface. Before touchdown, two large balloons will inflate to cushion the impact.
By Christmas Day 2003, when Beagle 2 was due to touch down, the mission had garnered huge public interest in Britain. And perhaps not surprisingly, it was, after all, an attempt on the cheap to land a bouncing ball on Mars, containing a tiny spacecraft that would try to answer one of the mysteries of the universe.
We had a room packed full of people, and it was quite a tense environment.
And what was your dad's mood like that morning? I mean, a lot of pressure on his shoulders, years of work going into this.
Yeah. I was worried, what if it didn't happen? So I did give him a good luck card. And I remember him being on the phone, and he was the only person who could hear the phone call, and everybody else in the room is waiting to see what happened. And they're all trying to judge his face and, like, is it good or bad?
So I was on a live telephone to a control centre in California, and a voice came on and said, I'm sorry, there's no data for you.
It was very disheartening, yeah, because it was still Christmas Day. So actually, we hadn't had a Christmas at all. There was no Christmas dinner, you know, real letdown.
Beagle's creator, Professor Colin Pillinger, said that he wouldn't give up until, as he put it, the final whistle blows. But he was already talking about the mission in the past tense. Professor Pillinger is now intent on raising funds to build a fleet of Beagles.
But that wasn't to be. An inquiry into what happened to Beagle 2 acknowledged that too little money had been put into the project at the beginning. But it also said that poor management was partly to blame, something Colin Pillinger vehemently disagreed with.
And that's what annoys me most, not that we believed that we failed, we didn't. We know how we could have done it better, and we weren't allowed to have another go. We still look for evidence of Beagle 2. I have one person, he compulsively looks at the pictures that NASA give us in the hope that he will find evidence of what happened, because if we did, we'd know how far we got, and then we'd know how to do it better the next time.
And in January 2015, less than a year after Professor Pillinger's death, Beagle 2 was finally located on the surface of Mars, apparently intact. Photos from NASA suggested that some of Beagle's solar panels had failed to open, blocking its antenna and so preventing it from communicating. Beagle 2, it turned out, wasn't so much a heroic failure as a heroic near miss.
I wish it happened before he died. I'd like him to have got proper recognition for it being found and for people to realise how far it got. And he'd be still a dog with a bone with that, pursuing that and working out what actually happened.
I can't imagine there are many people that haven't stood outside on a starry night and looked at the millions and myriads of stars and thought, I wonder if I'm alone. And this is what we were trying to do with seeing whether there was life on Mars.
And Colin Pillinger's dream of answering that question lives on. In 2019, the European Space Agency hopes to land a rover on Mars that will once again search for signs of life.
Rob Walker. Finally this week, we are returning to a moment of cultural history. In 1955, the world of publishing was shocked and in many quarters scandalised by what has come to be seen as among the most controversial books of the 20th century. It's the story of a man's obsession with a young girl, so young, in fact, that by today's standards, any intimate relationship between the two would be deemed illegal in most countries. Here's Lucy Burns.
Lolita, light of my life, fire of my loins, my sin, my soul, Lolita.
Author Vladimir Nabokov, or Nabokov, spoke to the BBC's Peter Duval Smith in 1962.
You've written a shelf of books in English.
A small shelf, yes.
And of them, really, only Lolita is well known. Does it annoy you to be the Lolita man?
No, I wouldn't say that, because Lolita is a very special favourite of mine. It was my most difficult book, the book that treated of a theme which was so distant, so remote from my own emotional life, that it gave me a special pleasure to use my combinational talent to make it real.
She was a very close person in some ways, at the same time with very, very strong views and ideas.
George Weidenfeld, now Lord Weidenfeld, was Lolita's UK publisher.
He had a very strange, interesting, weird sense of humour. He was a very strange person.
She was low, plain low in the morning, standing 4 feet 10 in one sock. She was Lola in slacks. She was Dolly at school. She was Dolores on the dotted line, but in my arms she was always Lolita.
Lolita is the story of American teenager Dolores Hayes and her seduction, or rape, by middle-aged Humbert Humbert, the narrator of the book. Robert Roper is the author of Nabokov in America, On the Road to Lolita.
It's a very simple but serious story. It's Humbert Humbert he's this pedophile, but he's also a very distinguished, highly educated European who finds himself in America. He rents a room in a house where a woman lives there. She's a widow and she has a little girl who's 12 years old. And Humbert Humbert is immediately smitten with her. And so he conspires to marry the woman so that he can get close to the daughter. So you see, it's kind of a monstrous, evil plot. I don't want to spoil the book for anybody who hasn't read it, but the mother is out of the picture at a certain point, and he inherits the little girl. And he immediately takes her out of school and sets off on a long, kind of aimless trip around America, staying at motels and visiting roadside attractions all over the country. During this period, he's sexually abusing this little girl.
Vladimir Nabokov had written Lolita in the early 1950s while teaching literature at Cornell University in New York State. Born into one of the richest families in Russia, he'd fled the revolution and settled in the US. He'd already written several novels in Russian and French, but Lolita was his breakthrough in English.
Did Lolita herself have an original?
As a matter of fact, I don't know little girls very well. I don't think I know a single little girl. I mean, I've never met little girls, really. Well, I've met them socially now and then. But Lolita is a figment of my imagination.
But writer and narrator did share a biographical detail, a formative romance at a very young age.
He, at the age of about 10, fell crazy in love with a little girl who was also about 10. It was this infatuation for both of them. And then she left. Then her family took her away and he lost her.
But there's no indication that the happily married Nabokov had an active interest in little girls as an adult.
I've looked really carefully at his life. I read all the letters I could, Russian and English. And earlier biographers have gone over his actual life very, very carefully. And there's absolutely no evidence that he ever interfered with little girls. But for him, it was very suggestive. It was because it was an evil impulse as well as a tremendously powerful one. It was a door opening onto a complexity of human behavior, of compulsion and fascination that for him was just very rich as a literary theme.
Lolita is an uncomfortable read. It's a disturbing insight into the mind of a sexual predator, but narrated in a very charming way.
It's a complicated literary book, but on one level, it's very, very easy to read. You immediately feel the humanity of this pedophile, Humbert Humbert, who is, whatever else you can say about him, he's tremendously entertaining. And also the little girl, Lolita, is a fascinating character. Her mother's a fascinating character.
He's a man with an obsession. And I think many of my characters have all certain obsessions, different kinds of obsessions.
Were you surprised at the wild success when it came?
Well, I was surprised that the book was published at all. I wasn't sure that I would find a publisher.
For a long time, no publisher would touch a novel narrated by a paedophile about his romance with a 13-year-old child. The book was eventually published in Paris in 1955 by Olympia Press, a company which also specialised in pornographic literature. George Weidenfeld published the book in Britain in 1959.
Graham Greene, whom I knew reasonably well, wrote in The New Yorker, I think, an article about this book, and he thought it should be published also properly. And I read it and was very taken by it. I think also I believed in freedom of publication. Perhaps I'm sort of rather a man who takes risks.
Because publishing the book in the UK carried the danger of being prosecuted under the Obscene Publications Act.
If pornography is meant simply as a neutral word of being a description of acts and relationships beyond the normal relationship between the sexes, it is pornography in a neutral sense of the word. As a publisher, I felt, has it literary value? That was really the criterion, quality and not contents.
Weidenfeld and his partner Nigel Nicholson decided to win over public opinion by recruiting famous intellectuals to a campaign against censorship.
Noel Allen, provost of King's College, had a glittering dinner party in which the great intellectuals of England, but also people like Stravinsky, Isaiah Berlin, of course, etc., came. Nabokov himself was the guest of honour, made a speech, and the subject of the speech was 19th century Russian novelists and the police. And he then talked about the great novelists and said, who in this room has not heard of Pushkin, Lermontov, Chekhov? Who in this room knows the single name of a head of the Petersburg police? And there was a standing ovation.
The book was passed by the British authorities and went on to be a bestseller.
When it came out, it was already known as this fascinating, sexy book, and people were just crazy to read it and had a tremendous success.
Since then, Lolita has sold more than 50 million copies. Many writers have called it one of their favourite books. But for some readers, the book's literary qualities and its author's reputation were overshadowed by its subject matter.
I don't think that has a specially perverse or cruel streak in my writing. I mean, I'm a mild old gentleman. I'm very kind. There's nothing cruel or brutal in me whatsoever.
Lucy Burns recalling the scandalous publication of Vladimir Nabokov's Lolita 60 years ago. And that's it from this edition of The History Hour. Plenty more first-hand recollections to look forward to in the year ahead. So I hope you can join me for those starting next week. This is Max Pearson. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
This is the BBC World Service. The news is next, after some music for the soul.
Music runs like a thread through the story of our lives. Soul music listens to some of those stories and plays the music that accompanies them.
Soul music at bbcworldservice.com. And in 30 minutes on the BBC World Service...
In the Balance ponders the major economic moments that defined 2015. China's share price plunge, the VW scandal, more crisis in the Eurozone. What has all this meant for our livelihoods? Stay with us. The Inquiry is next.
This is the BBC World Service, the world's radio station. BBC World Service. This is Ruth Alexander with The Inquiry. This week, how will a population boom change Africa?
The population is currently around 1.2 billion, and we anticipate 2.5 billion by the middle of the century.
The number of Africans is predicted to double in just 35 years. This is unprecedented growth.
It is quite palpable. You could see it not only in heavy traffic, but also pressure on social services, you know, like water, electricity, schools.
If leaders don't plan for the challenge that's ahead, they risk large-scale political unrest.
We might find the sort of thing that happened in the Arab Spring could happen in Nigeria.
But there's also the potential to harness the power of a fast-growing young workforce.
Africa will become a much more important part of the world.
So will a population boom break or make the continent? That's The Inquiry after the news.
Hello, I'm Neil Nunes with the BBC News. More than 100,000 people in Paraguay, Argentina, Brazil and Uruguay have been forced to leave their homes by some of the worst floods in the region in five decades. Several days of heavy rain have caused three major rivers to swell. Leonardo Rocha has more.
The flooding has destroyed homes, electricity pylons and ruined farms in a vast area of lowlands encircled by three major South American rivers, the Paraguay, the Uruguay and the Paraná. In the worst affected country, Paraguay, the authorities have blamed the El Niño phenomenon for stronger than usual summer storms. The capital, Asunción, has been flooded and has been affected by power cuts. A state of emergency has been declared in several regions of the country. Thousands of families have also been badly affected in neighboring Argentina, Brazil and Uruguay.
Saturday's planned evacuation of Syrian rebel fighters and their families from the Yarmouk refugee camp south of Damascus has been put on hold. A monitoring group said there were logistical difficulties, including arranging buses. The pullout was to involve militants from the Islamic State group who earlier this year overran the Yarmouk area. In return, the United Nations was to deliver aid to those trapped in the camp. Chris Gunness of the UN Relief and Works Agency told the BBC why aid organisation needs to get into the camp.
We have not had access to the camp since the 28th of March. That was 3 days before ISIS moved into the camp. The Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, even before ISIS moved in, described the camp as a refugee camp that had been turned into a death camp. He said it was akin to one of the lower reaches of hell.
A Chicago police officer has shot dead two people while responding to a domestic disturbance on the city's west side. The victims were a 19-year-old man and a 55-year-old woman. Both were black, and their families have accused the police of overreacting. Amnesty International says the Cameroonian authorities must come clean over the fate of 130 people rounded up and detained by its security forces a year ago following operations against the Islamist militant group Boko Haram. David Bamford has the details.
Exactly 1 year ago, on the 27th of December, more than 200 boys and men were arrested by Cameroonian security forces in two villages, Magdeme and Duble. According to the government, 70 suspected Boko Haram members were arrested, 25 of whom died that night in a prison cell at the gendarmerie in Marawa. But the whereabouts of at least 130 remaining people are still unknown. Amnesty International says the fight against Boko Haram should not serve as a pretext for enforced disappearances.
World News from the BBC. Reports from northeast Nigeria say at least 14 people were killed and several others injured in an attack on Friday by Boko Haram. Witnesses say gunmen entered the village of Kimba in Borno State on bicycles, opening fire on residents and burning their homes. A wildfire in Southern California has prompted evacuations and road closures. Hundreds of firefighters are trying to contain a blaze in the Solomon Beach area northwest of Los Angeles. Several local communities have been evacuated and a stretch of the Pacific Coast Highway has been closed. Fred Bruce from the Ventura County Fire Department said the firefighters are doing their best to contain the fire.
There's no homes immediately threatened, but we want to make sure that the communities are safe to reoccupy before we allow the residents to go back. Don't know exactly where the fire started. I don't have the information on where the point of origin is. The fire was wind-driven with an offshore wind, so it started in the high country and blew down to the coast.
Chinese media report that